This episode of Harvey Brownstone Interviews is brought to you by the Harvey Brownstone Talk Show Blend Coffee, available at HollywoodBlends.com. Everyone's saying it's the best coffee they've ever tasted. Why not give it a try and see for yourself?
Hello, everyone. I'm Harvey Brownstone, and today's guest is a highly popular actor who's been immortalized for his hilarious performance as Lyle, the railroad supervisor in the classic Mel Brooks movie, Blazing Saddles. We also remember him as Floyd, the desk clerk in Paper Moon, and he played the Colt gun salesman in Back to the Future Part 3. And he was Roy Bacon in Honeymoon in Vegas. He's also appeared in many more great movies, and some of my favorites are Thunderbolt and Lightfoot, At Long Last Love, Farewell My Lovely, Hearts of the West, Fletch, The Getaway, 88 Hits, Drop Dead Sexy, Killing Down, and Return to Vengeance. On television, he played Virgil on Evening Shade, and he's guest starred in dozens of classic TV series, including Cannon, The Waltons, Charlie's Angels, Alice, How the West Was Won, Soap, The Dukes of Hazzard, Knight Rider, and Mama's Family, to name just a few. And he's appeared in a number of terrific TV movies and miniseries, including Remember When, The Night That Panicked America, The Ransom of Red Chief, Dream West, North and South Book 2, The Love Bug, and many more. Before he became an actor, he was a very well-known boxer, and he served as a firefighter in Dallas for 14 years. But for over 50 years, he's been entertaining audiences with that big smile and unforgettable personality that makes every role he plays so memorable. I'm delighted to welcome the one and only Burton Gilliam to our show. Burton, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, gosh, thank you. Wow. It sounds like I've done a lot of stuff. And I am proud to be here because I'm sitting here talking to Harvey Brownstone, who is famous for what we're doing right here. So thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for saying that. The honor is all mine. You know, Burton, the story of how you went from being a boxer and a firefighter in Dallas, Texas, to a movie star is legendary. You managed to get a speaking role in Paper Moon when you were just hoping to be an extra. You had a full-time job as a firefighter. Why did you even want to be an extra?
I don't know. I was sitting around the fire station one day in 1972, in June of 72, and I just saw this article in the paper that said some big director I'd never heard of, Peter Bogdanovich, was coming to Dallas to audition people to be extras in a picture called Paper Moon. Ryan O'Neill was the star of the show. Wow, I might get to see Ryan O'Neill. That was my main objective for going down and trying to be an extra.
Well, before Paper Moon, had you ever thought of being an actor?
Never. No. I'd never been in a grade school play. I'd never done anything in high school that would lead me to think that I had any talent at all for standing in front of a camera.
Well, I'm trying to imagine you there on the set with Peter Bogdanovich, Ryan O'Neill, his daughter Tatum, Madeline Kahn, your first time on a movie set. Did you get a lot of coaching from the others, or did acting just come naturally to you?
It just came naturally. I'd like to say, yeah, I had a whole, well, I did have a lot of help. And after every take, they would say, that is perfect. Just stay right with that, right there. You know, that's the help I got. You know, Peter's gone now. But when he worked, he always told everybody what to do. He knew exactly where I was going to go after he said action. He knew where Ryan was going to go. He knew how we were going to say things. He knew if we were going to reach over and take something off of a desk. I had all of the movements for me, as did Ryan, as did Madeline, and of course Tatum, the Academy Award winner. But the movements and whatever we did were pre-done by Peter.
Well, he must have been very happy with you because he cast you again in At Long Last Love with Burt Reynolds, Sybil Shepherd, Madeleine Kahn. Did you have fun making that movie?
Oh boy, it was great because I had been in the business about a year then, and I knew my way around just a little bit. I had moved to Hollywood. It took me a while to find the Hollywood freeway. I was at a brand new place with brand new people, doing a brand new business that I knew nothing about. And those were the wonderful days of my life because every day was something new.
But when you finished Paper Moon, Burton, did you ever think that you would do any more acting?
Nope. I went back to the fire station, and everybody on the picture said, "Come to Hollywood, you can get a lot of work." Oh no, I got 14 years at the fire department, so I went back to the fire station and was satisfied with that. Of course, everybody was giving me a bad time. All firemen do that, when something happens that makes you stand out a little, they give you a hoorah and this and that and the other. So I just went back to the fire station.
Well, Burton, here's the really phenomenal thing about your story. It's one thing for an extra to get a speaking role in a movie, which happened to you in Paper Moon, but then a few months later, lightning struck twice when Mel Brooks offered you a great role in Blazing Saddles. Did you even know who Mel Brooks was?
I was at the fire station. I answered the phone. Thusly, fire station number 39, Gilliam speaking. And this guy says, "My name's Mel Brooks. I'm a writer, director, producer, and actor, and I'm getting ready to do a big picture. I want you to be one of my stars." And I said, "Thank you, Mr. Brooks." Boom. I hung up the phone because I knew it was another fireman giving me a bad time. Paper Moon had not been released, and nobody at the fire station knew what kind of role I had, and it was a great role to break in on.
Well, you had 14 years seniority as a firefighter. You had no vacation time left, so you had to quit your job to be in Blazing Saddles. Were you nervous about quitting your job?
I guess I was nervous, but I knew from the moment I was offered that, and offered so much money I never dreamed of making it. That's a fact. And I did quit. I had two people in my corner, my sister and my attorney. They both said, "Go for it, go for it. This might just work." Everybody I knew was saying, "You are crazy. You're not an actor. You can't do that." Mel Brooks is on the other end. He was saying, "You can do this." It took me 3 weeks and three trips to Los Angeles for him to convince me to do it. But I think I wanted to do it from the very get-go, as soon as he offered it to me.
Well, they offered you the amount you made in a year as a firefighter, $12,000. So looking back, Burton, do you think maybe you didn't ask for enough money?
Oh, I know I didn't. I made 2.5 times as much in 4.5 weeks that it would have taken me 2 years to make. But here I am talking about money over a desk with a multimillionaire. I'm making $12,000 a year. He said, "How much are you going to take us to get you to do this picture?" And I said, "Well, I can't do it for any less than I make in a year. That's $12,000." He said, "That's $4,000 a week. That's fine." And I said, "What?" I couldn't believe he said, "Okay." And then I had an extra week. I had overtime. $25,000 just came flowing out of nowhere. And the first thing I did was I went back to Dallas, got a U-Haul, put a bunch of stuff in it, and headed back to Los Angeles. Got
And
an
the rest
apartment.
is history.
the rest is history. And that's when I started learning about acting, because at that time I knew nothing. I'd done two pictures, but I did not know any of the little small things that go on behind the camera. I knew nothing, but I learned them in the next couple of years. I learned pretty well.
Oh, I would certainly say so. Now, Burton, how much did you know about the script of Blazing Saddles before you agreed to be Lyle?
I said the N-word. I'm the first person in the picture to say the N-word. I'm the first person you'd see in the picture. I'm from Dallas, Texas. I've heard the real, I'm not the N-word. I've heard the real word all of my life. And when I was a kid, 4 to 15 years old, nothing was ever said about that word. It was just a word that was used, and people, the black community, I guess more or less accepted it, and the white community just laid it out there. And I think when I've never talked to Mel about this, but I think he had an idea. Peter Bogdanovich told him I was from Dallas, and I bet he said, "Oh, that's perfect," because he knows the N-word and he knows how to say it really well, and he's not gonna blink when he says it. And I did blink when I said it.
Well, you've spoken many times about how uncomfortable you felt saying all those racial insults in Blazing Saddles, and of course, filming that famous farting scene around the campfire. So, what goes through your mind when you see those scenes nowadays?
I'm so proud of Call me what you want to call me, but I am proud of them. And I know that the fart scene is, I think, the longest scene. Well, it was, I'm the very first person to fart in a movie. The first. And Mel came to my trailer that day and said, "You're going to be, I'm going to make you famous. You're going to be the first one to fart." And I just accepted that as part of making movies. I didn't know it was the first one. After we did it, he said, "Oh, yeah, you're the first one. This is the first ever." I said, "Oh my gosh." My mother would be so proud.
It is a rather unusual distinction. So, what was it like working with Mel Brooks? What did you think of him?
Working with Peter tells everybody everything, every move you make. Mel says, "Know your lines, get out there and do it." And boy, I went in a day early, and I'm glad that I did, because I saw exactly how he was working with Cleavon and how he was working with the other actors. He just said action, and they started their scene, and I said, "Whoa, he doesn't tell you where to go and what to do and how to do. I better make this something up in there and be ready to go." And I did.
You mentioned the other actors. There was Gene Wilder, Harvey Korman, Slim Pickens, Madeline Kahn. Did you get to know any of them?
Oh, golly, Slim became my very best friend, and that would be a natural thing, because Slim and I, Slim was really from California, but everybody said, "Well, where's he from? Oklahoma or Texas?" I said, "Neither one, California." He took me under his wing. He said, "You're going to be working as an actor as I work as an actor. Make yourself exactly, play your characters exactly as who you are. If they want to change anything, let them try to do it. If they can't do it, go with what you've got." And Slim had the right idea. I wish I had the career that he had, because he was one of the great character actors of all time.
Well, a lot of people would say the same thing about you because you are not just an actor, you're a personality. You have a personality that comes through everything you do because I think people believe you're just being yourself.
I must say I've heard that before, and I don't know where it comes from. Yeah, I do know where it comes. It comes from being me, and I wish I could tell others how to be me, not be them, but be me.
No, it wouldn't work because you have to be yourself. So,
I guess that's right.
do you think a movie like Blazing Saddles could ever be made today?
Nope, it sure can't. And that's a sad thing. And Mel and I will talk about that nearly every time we talk. We talk two or three times a year. He will say, "I know that we can't make Blazing Saddles again, but if we could, we'd be on Blazing Saddles 8." And I have to believe that is true. Mel, whenever he goes to his office, if something just comes into his mind, some kind of a scene, maybe not to fit Blazing Saddles, but to fit a movie that's ever been done. But it's something that just pops in his head. He's going to sit down and write a scene that may take 30 minutes, put it in a drawer, and he's done that all of his life. And all of the movies, the hit movies he's done, he's pulled pieces of paper out of that drawer there and said, "Oh, yes, we're going to put this in there."
I know you've attended many screenings of Blazing Saddles and you've done Q&A sessions afterwards. And I'm just wondering, have you ever been shocked by any of the questions you've been asked by fans?
No, I've never been shocked. Gosh, I'm thinking back. No, I've never been shocked, and I've never been put on the spot, as some actors are put on the spot sometime. But I've never been put on the spot. Maybe that's a thing that people might want to be put on the spot sometime. But I've never
Okay, I'll make sure not to put you on the spot today.
been.
Did your parents live long enough to see you become a famous actor?
They both passed. My mother passed away 2 years before I became an actor, and my father passed away a year before I became an actor. My mother would have said, "Go get them." My father would have said, "I come from nine. Now there have been nine people in my family who are firefighters. There's only one left. A grandson he's got 4 years in the fire department." But my father would not have approved of me quitting the fire department. I know he wouldn't have. But I think after about 2 years, I think he would have come around. I think he would have said, "You made a great choice." I followed my father's footsteps as much as I could, because my father was, he had it up here, you know. He didn't have a real education. He was an orphan, and he went to an orphanage, lived in an orphanage till he was 16. He knew about the stars, and I'm talking about the stars up in the sky, and he knew about the earth, and he knew about the basic things of life, but he knew them very, very well. I have taken after him in many ways.
That's a wonderful thing. And I think wherever your parents are, they are really proud of you. Now, you co-starred with Clint Eastwood, Jeff Bridges, and George Kennedy in Thunderbolt and Lightfoot. Can you share any stories from your time working with them, Burton?
Yeah, Clint was very distant. I did three scenes with him, and he would just, between takes while we were doing scenes, he would go sit by himself somewhere. And I think maybe that's the way he usually worked. Or It may have been the fact that I was brand new. I say I was brand new. I guess I'd been there about 6 months or so. And it may have been that he just wanted to give me some space. But I think, and as I was, he was sitting on the fender of a car, and a guy walked up to me and said, "Can I get your autograph?" And I said, "For sure." And so I give him an autograph, and he said, "Now, would you get Mr. Eastwood? Would you get him?" I found out right real quickly, that I was a stepping stone to somebody bigger than me.
I think that's amazing that you found yourself with these people and you weren't intimidated.
I just said, I knew that much about the business. I wasn't going to turn him on to Clint and have Clint say, "Well, what'd you bring him over to me for?" So I learned something right there. I didn't really learn. I guess I already knew it intuitively, but I used it. I never had to say, "Hey, I'm not taking you. You go over by yourself, pal."
Yeah, you really knew how to handle yourself. And I know that you worked with my dear friend Robbie Benson at least twice in the 1974 TV movie Remember When and on the TV show Evening Shade. Tell me about your friendship with Robbie. I just adore the guy.
I adore the guy. I adore the guy. I met him. We were doing a television movie up in Sacramento called Three Stars in the Window, or maybe it was Four Stars in the Window. I forgot. But back in World War II, if you had a child or a relative in the war, you put a star in your window. This family had 3 or 4 stars in the window, whatever it was. And Robbie was 17 years old. He was part of this family. And I was a GI who was happened to be home for some reason. I met them. And Robbie, I don't want to, Robbie was knew more about making film than anybody I had met in the first 6 or 7 months out there, and he was 17. His parents, he was in high school in New York. Actually, Robbie is from Dallas, but he's from the time he was about 6 months old, he lived in New York, so he's a New Yorker. His parents asked me if, after the movie, after we got through shooting, which, and that was in December. They said he's graduating from high school in June. Could he come out and stay with you for a while? I said, "Golly, yeah." And he came out as soon as he graduated from high school. And Robbie, here I am. I was 34 years old, about to turn 35. He was 17, and we just meshed. I had an apartment. I said, "Come in, throw your stuff in there." Robbie and I were like the same person. We just meshed. We knew every good hamburger joint in Toluca Lake, Burbank. He was just a kid, and he brought me back to being a kid for a while. He was with me for about 6 months. Then he worked the whole time. He was just real busy, and I learned half of what I know now. I learned from Robbie Benson. Robbie is still my friend. I love Robbie Benson. He presented me with a big an award in Los Angeles about 2 years ago. I knew I was going to get the award. I asked if he would do it, and he said, "Sure." Robbie lives somewhere up by Seattle now, but he's just a wonderful person. He is a good guy. He's soft. He's mellow. He's
Kind. He's so kind.
Kind. I know I'm not telling you anything about him because it just sticks out of him, you know? He would not want to hurt your feelings or my feelings, anybody's. He's just a good, kind person.
He sure is, and I'm so glad that you paid tribute to him on our show. Now, I mentioned Evening Shade, which starred Burt Reynolds. You had a recurring role as Virgil on that show, and you also worked with Burt in At Long Last Love and Gator.
Yeah.
You were very close friends with Burt Reynolds, weren't you?
Yes, I did. And he was just wonderful to me. And I really think now that I look back at it, he expected more of me. And I mean that in a good way. He expected that that directors and producers and casting directors would see what he saw. Because Bert, every time I was worked with him or was anywhere with him, he was with me. I mean, I wasn't just a guy who was following along behind Burt Reynolds. Burt Reynolds and I were together. About 2 weeks before he passed, he sent me a video, and in it he had on I bet he weighed 125 pounds. He did not look good. He had on a suit that was way too big for him. He was sitting in a stu overstuffed chair, had a cane next to him. The video comes on and he says, "Hi, Burton, I haven't seen you in a while. Said I just wanted to tell you that I love you. And I'm looking forward to seeing you again. And I don't want you to cry for me. I want you to be glad that we had our time together. So I look forward to seeing you again."
Oh, Burton, that's heartbreaking.
It's one of the kindest things. And Bert was kind. If you got on Bert's wrong side, he was not a good person to you. And he expected you to be the kind of person you should be. That's a fact. I learned so much from Burt Reynolds, and he and Robbie Benson and I should have lived together or something. We should have been together all the time for 25 years or something because we were into each other and how we handled problems, and it was wonderful.
You know, Burton, I think the reason so many Hollywood stars really liked you is because you were not the typical actor. You were a real person that came from real life. You didn't spend all your early years studying acting. You didn't have that driving ambition that all those young actors had. You fell into the industry and they saw the real world in you because you stayed genuine, you stayed humble. You were not really an industry insider, and I think they found that very comforting. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. And those thoughts have run through my mind many times. I'm just so proud that I had a life before I ever knew anything at all about acting. And I hope I bring that life, maybe not in scene, maybe you don't know that I'm bringing those things to life, but I am.
Yes, you're bringing authenticity, sincerity. And look at the stars. I mentioned the stars that like you. You worked with Robert Mitchum in Farewell, My Lovely. Did you get to spend any time with him?
Oh boy, you bet I did. And Robert, I'm telling you, it was the he was a good guy, but he was the opposite kind of a person in the way other people saw him and the way he put himself out there. Oh, every on a picture that we did, at Long Last Love. Everybody loved Robert Mitchum, except the big guys, the producers, the writers, the director. I mean, he was on them all the time because he knew what their job was. He really did. And when they fell short on their job, he let them know it, and in no uncertain terms. He invited our director out on the street, said, "Hey, we'll go out on the street and we'll settle this, pal." And as they was, I don't know what has become of Dick Richards, but it was Dick Richards, the director. Dick was a kind of all over the place, and Robert would put him, he'd stick up for actors and he'd stick up for himself. He'd say, "Get back on the right road to this thing, Richards, because you're moving off of the thing." He was a guy who stood up for himself. He probably even went over the line a little.
Yeah, that was his reputation. And another legendary star, and also a very dear friend of mine, Louis Gossett Jr., whom we lost last year. I did his very last interview. You were in a great TV movie in 1978 with Lou called Lawman Without a Gun. Did you get to know
Yes,
Lou at all?
I did not. But what a great actor he was for his kind of parts, He was just, I wish I could put a word on it. And I've worked with so many actors who are so different, Some of them were known to be great actors, actresses. I did not see that in them. Maybe I was looking for the wrong thing, but some of the people that I worked with were, a lot of the people were stage actors, and those people are good. But there's a difference between working on the stage and working in front of the camera. I do think that working in front of the camera is much harder than working on stage because you've got so much stuff around you and so many different people telling you what to do. Once you've finished with your work, you go on. If you're a stage actor, actress, your work is the same tonight, tomorrow, tomorrow night. You may work, do six shows in a week, and they're all going to be pretty much the same. So I think once people leave the stage, it's even though they know lines and everything, it's a hard switch to do it in front of a camera.
Well, Lou Gossett certainly could do it all.
Oh.
You worked with Leslie Nielsen and Tippi Hedren in Foxfire Light. You worked with Nicolas Cage and James Caan when you played Roy Bacon in Honeymoon in Vegas. You must have so many great stories about each of these people and all those movies.
You know what? Between these ears somewhere, I've got a book running around in there. I know I do. And everybody knows I do. And I've talked to a number of writers that have done famous people, but in the last couple of years, I've talked to a number of them, and I just haven't talked to the right one. And some of them won't astronomical fee just to get the thing going, but I do have a something in there that I think people would want to read about.
Oh, Burton, absolutely. You've worked with some of the greatest legends. I've mentioned a lot of them. I'm going to mention another one. In 1986, you worked with the wonderful Carol O'Connor in a TV movie called Convicted. Now, he was always known as Archie Bunker,
Oh,
but
right.
you
Yeah,
saw him in a different, very different role.
and I wasn't prepared for how good he was. And he was one of those guys that a director did not have to tell him very much. He was his own director. He did not do, when you're doing a picture, you're expected scene after scene of the same scene, you're expected to do the same thing maybe 7 or 8 times right in a row. He didn't do that, and he didn't say that. He would say something that would be acceptable, that could work in there very well. He could get out of a chair and walk around behind it when he wasn't, they had never rehearsed that, but he just instinctively knew that it would work. And every now and then, I remember, I've forgotten who the director was, but he said something to him. Don't go, please don't go around the chair that way. I thought he was correcting you. He said, go around the other way, not to the left, go to the right. Yeah, that was an honor just to work with him because he had already made his fame, you know.
He was a real improviser. That's what it sounds like.
Oh gosh, I don't know. I'm sure I never got to do much with him, so I don't know his, I didn't know his background, still don't know his background, but I know it had to be from New York or somewhere where he had a lot of stage learning. Yeah, great guy too.
And I have to mention, in 1987, you guest starred in one of my favorite sitcoms, Mama's Family. You played Bud in a season 4 episode called Workman's Holiday, which was about an old lunchbox that Mama made. Did
Yeah.
you have fun working with Vicki Lawrence and Ken Berry?
It was just great. They worked in that kind of a show. They worked so fast. It wasn't like a 4-camera show where you rehearse 4 days and then on Friday you shoot it. It was a sitcom where, it was done with one camera and they you just work day after day and scene after scene. Those people had done that so much that they could do it blindfolded, and they were so good. Golly, when you work with people who like that, who are steeped in television, what's the man's the character? What is his name?
You mean Ken Berry?
Yes, Ken Berry. He was, I mean, I worshipped him from in front of the TV for many years, and boy, he was a loose cannon. You would always be, you could be surprised that what might come out of his mouth that would work. He did not go with the script, wow, very much, and they really expect you to do that, but everything he did seemed like it worked. It was a hit show for a number of years and had great people on it. They had great guest stars on the show. It was one of those, I wish I had been a regular on that show. That's the one show that I could have really had a great time with the small cast that they had. That would have been great.
Yeah, that would have been great. Well, Burton, when you very kindly agreed to appear on our show, you said something in your email that really intrigued me. I'm going to read it back to you. You said, "There is no good reason I've had such an outstanding career as an actor. I've been blessed to have worked with so many huge stars and got to call them friends. It just happened." So, Burton, let me ask you, how much of your success as an actor do you attribute to hard work, and how much was just good luck?
I think most of it, now that you put the question that way, I think most of it is because great agents, the people that I worked with, the actors, cared about me. For the first 3 years, 4 years, I was still the new guy in town. I was still the new guy that did Blazing Saddles. That was my kicker right there. I mean, I could go into any interview and people would look up and say, "Oh, you're the guy, you were in Blazing Saddles, weren't you?" But I think the best part of my career has been the fact that I, not that I knew so many people, it's the fact that I knew, in many cases, the right people. And I had a good rapport with my agents. I let them guide me and direct me because the first director I had didn't guide me and direct me. He's no longer with us. Here I was, a new kid in town. I had just done Blazing Saddles and Paper Moon, and they neither had been released. And if he had been on the ball, he would have done something really. He would have said, "Hey, for Paper Moon, get you an ad in the Hollywood Reporter. Cost you $500. Get you an ad in there that says for consideration for your part in Paper Moon, because it is worthy,
Of
and
an
you're not
award.
a." Yes. Oh gosh, yeah. I know I could have. I got a number. I know I got a lot of votes, but I don't have many. Can I tell? Let me tell you something that nobody knows this. Peter Bogdanovich came to Dallas about 12 or 14 years ago for a film festival, and I'm not sure what, but it was a big one, a really big one. When I saw Peter Bogdanovich, we went to lunch, and he said, "Burton, I want to tell you something. I'll drop the ball on you because I think I could have gotten you an Academy Award nomination out of Paper Moon." When Ben Johnson did Last Picture Show, he said, "I recognized how good he was and how much he meant to the picture. So I added four scenes in the picture that we did not have before." He said, "I wrote them in there, and Ben had twice as much to do as he did." He said, "That is what won him the Academy Award. If his part had still stayed at little four scenes, it wouldn't have happened. Your part stayed at four scenes, and I did not realize until we got in the cutting room and started putting things together, music together, adding sounds, doing things, I realized I should have written you four more scenes and gotten you an Academy Award nomination." That's one of the finest tributes I've ever gotten from from anybody in the business. That was really hot stuff, you know.
You've never talked about that before, Burton. Why not?
Just, I don't know. I just haven't. I've probably told that to a friend or two, and I don't even know if my wife knows that. I think she probably does, but there's three or four people that know it. Now, I wish we could have gone back. I would have liked to have talked more about that with Peter, because I did work with Ben on a mini series one time, and he was just great. But of course, this is before I knew how Peter had written those scenes for him and got him an Academy Award nomination, which he won, you know.
But do you think, looking back, Burton, do you think an Academy Award would have made a huge difference in terms of the roles that you got in your
Yeah,
career?
I do. I do. I've been limited because I got right to the point of of a lion you step over. And I never was able to step over that lion if, right off the bat, I had gotten a nomination. I know my name would have been on people's lips, or they would have, actors would have said, "Hey, did you see that guy, that new guy in Paper Moon?" And directors would say, "Hey, let's take a look at that guy, whoever he is." Casting directors would have said that. Producers, and that's not, I don't want to be sounding like I'm throwing rocks at anybody. The more your name is out there, the better your chances are of getting a part, getting nominated, getting asked to dinner or whatever, you know.
Well, have you had many times in your life where you were watching a movie or a TV show and you thought, I should have had that part. I could have done that better.
Yes, I have done that quite a few times. I've done that even in commercials, you know, and I've done a lot of commercials, a lot. I'm real proud of some of the commercials I did, but I do think everybody, if you know you've done a good job, if you know it, you should feel good about yourself. I did a pilot one time called The Girl, The Gold Watch, and Dynamite. And I had like the fourth lead in it. My name was Hoover Hess. Hoover Hess. And I was a some kind of a detective, you know, a goofball detective. And but the pilot didn't go. But they liked it so much, they wanted to do another show, and they could not get the stars back again. They were already doing another series. So they got somebody else, and it made me the second lead in the thing. And at that time, I did not know that I could carry a show. After we had been on the show for about a week, it was a 3-week shoot up in Sacramento. The producer and director came to me and said, "Burton, your character has taken over the show. And it's not written that way. It just has happened. We're going to rewrite this thing, and you are going to be, it's going to look like you're the star of the show." And I said, "Okay." It did not go either. But I learned something on the thing because they wrote so many lines for me, and I was never. That's one thing that bothered me for the first 5 or 6 years, 7 years. I was not comfortable with knowing a lot of lines. On this, they call the second one The Girl, The Gold Watch, and Everything. The first one was The Girl, Gold Watch, and Dynamite. Yeah. But I learned that I could do so many lines, so many lines. And when I finished, the day I finished about noon. The picture did not wrap until that evening. They had a car that took me back to Los Angeles. We were out somewhere on the desert. I sat in the back of that van, and I was so proud that I had learned that I could do a lot of lines. I could do them. There's a difference between knowing your lines and knowing your lines. I found out I knew my lines. I sat back there and I boo-hooed. I said, "I can do this. I can really do it now if people will just give me the shot at it, you know."
Well, I think you should be enormously proud that for someone who had absolutely no acting training, you had no experience, you landed in movies that were huge, you did learn your lines well enough to be so convincing and so believable that you have a huge body of work, which you heard in my introduction. I think you should be enormously proud. Of course, it would have been nice if Mr. Bogdanovich had beefed up your role a little more Ian Paper Moon. But you can never know what might have happened.
That's right. That's exactly right. We don't know, you know.
It might not all have been so great, because many people have talked about the Oscar curse. You know, when we had Carol Kane on the show, she didn't work for a year after that Oscar nomination.
Really? Is
And
wow.
Many actors have told me about the Oscar curse, that, you know, you get an Oscar and then you don't work because suddenly you're so identified with one role that nobody wants to see you for anything else. So I've got to say, you're quite an amazing person to have remained so genuine, to have learned on the job. You learned on the job.
I did.
So here you are, Burton. You're in your 80s. You've had a successful boxing career, a 14-year career as a firefighter. And for over 50 years, you've been a movie and TV star. How would you like to be remembered?
I really think there's my private life and the actor life, and both of them, the same answer to both of them. When I'm gone, I would like for the people to say, he was a good guy.
I think there's no doubt that people will say that. And I have to tell you, it's been such a pleasure meeting you and having this chance to reminisce with you about your life and your career. You really are a good guy, Burton. You have absolutely no ego. You're the kindest, nicest person, and you really seem to read people well. You know who you can trust, and you know who really cares. And I respect you so much for that.
Well, let me turn the tables on you for a minute here then. I've done a lot of these interview shows, a lot. I say a lot. I've done a good 100 of them in the last 10 years. You are the best. And
Oh,
I wouldn't say, I don't say that to people. Your interview with me is just like me sitting down talking to the guy next door. So you want to know how I became an actor? You know, okay, look, when you get home from work tomorrow night, let's go have dinner and we'll talk about that. You know, you are a magician at it, really. I'm not saying that. It's true. And I hope you will keep me somewhere, my phone number, in your book somewhere.
Well, I want to tell you that means the world to me that I made you happy. I absolutely will keep your phone number on my phone. And I feel like getting on a plane, going down to Dallas and having dinner with you.
Now, are you in New York?
I'm in Toronto.
You're in Toronto. Okay. Well, that's close. That's close enough to New York.
Well, I tell you, I'm sure we will meet in person. I'll make a point of it. I want to thank you for all the entertainment you've given to the world over the years, all of the joy you've brought to people and the laughter. Most of all, thank you so much for taking the time to appear on our show, Burton.
Well, thank you so much. And I'm putting my hand over my heart. I know what that means to me. Thank you for having me on your show. If I could ever do anything for you, you got the number, okay?
The best thing you can do for me is to stay well, never change, and we'll be in touch very soon. Our guest has been the one and only Burton Gilliam. My name is Harvey Brownstone. Thank you all for joining us. See you next time. Thank you to my producer, Steve Silver, my managers, Rick Marcelli and Robin Bragg Marcelli of the Marcelli Company in Hollywood, my director of programming, Robert Monaghan, my editor, Isaiah Sharalampadis, and my entire team at the XPTV1 network in the UK.
Thanks for watching. Be sure to check out all the great interviews on the Harvey Brownstone Interviews YouTube channel. Don't forget to subscribe and ring the bell to be notified when new videos are posted.
Hey, hockey fans! can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at USAHockeyNTDP.com and see America's NHL Stars of Tomorrow.